It's a pleasure to have you here. Can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Anish Mehmet. I am co-founder, CTO, and the chief scientist for PodPanther Protocol. I've been in crypto, traditional crypto, as in cryptographic research, for 20 odd years. I went to grad school to do cryptography. In crypto as we know it, I've been there since, I would say, like, very actively. So I'm one of the people who have been on the ski.crypt and the cryptography mailing list. So whenever the paper was published, I was there. I didn't really jump in and do anything, so nothing of that sort. But 2011 onwards, I've been quite active. 2013, I became an advisor to Ripple. When Ethereum became a thing, when Ethereum Swarm was a thing, I, you know, volunteered a bit. So I'm one of the original reviewers of the Ethereum Orange Paper, and I did give a couple of Swarm Summit talks. And then over the years, I ended up designing a whole bunch of protocols, as in dApps. So probably like 20, give or take. Well-known ones are like Ocean, Boson, Pillar, things like that. Then I've, in total, probably worked on like half a dozen layer ones, like obvious ones I said in the start. Then the less obvious ones, I can't probably name them due to legal reasons. These are like consulting jobs that I had to do for other people. And then, you know, most recently, I've been interested in ZK and FHE, ZK for a reasonably long time. In the non-interactive version, probably like 8 years, give or take. And this is my third ZK startup. And yeah, that's where we are.
Wow, yeah, there's quite a bit to unpack here. So you've graduated in cryptography, and you've been studying it.
No, I should probably give you a bit of background. I have a degree in medicine, and after having I decided that, you know, I was quite clear that I'm not going to be a medical doctor, so I wanted to go learn cryptography. That is a long story behind it, but in summary, it's like I really, really was sure that I wanted to learn cryptography.
That's such a weird jump to make from medicine to cryptography, especially back in the day, because I imagine cryptography was something very unpopular.
Esoteric. That would be the word I would use.
So how did you come across, and how did you realize that this was a path you wanted to take?
Oh, it's a very simple story. If I tell you the story, you're going to laugh. So when I grew up in India, my dad used to subscribe to a magazine called Science Today. And one of the issues in Science Today, I think in the early 80s or late 70s, there was this article. So this is, and my dad reads Science Today and keeps it in a pile in the side of the room. I go pick them up and read. So I came across one of them. And this is definitely like, you know, it is all in all likelihood early 80s, because, you know, 77, 78 is like when RSA was found, and then Martin Gardner had a challenge in it, right? So Martin Gardner had this challenge for RSA 129, and he offered $100, right? So Martin Gardner has this column that comes in this magazine, Indian magazine, called Science Today. So as a kid, I used to solve it. I mean, to me, this is like, okay, this is an interesting thing to solve. And I see this and I go, really? It's like $100 an Indian kid in the 80s, early 80s. It's a large sum of money. I'm like, how hard can this be? How wrong could I be is the answer to that one. You know, and that dragged me into this whole, rabbit hole of cryptography, and I never escaped. So here I am, I'm still interested in cryptography.
I see. So it's something that you found actually since you were a kid.
Yes, and accidentally. I found accidentally as a kid. As I grew up, my interest grew a lot more. So I managed to get hold of a lot of the classical cryptanalysis text. I learned all those things. When Bruce Schneier published his book, then I got access to a photocopy of a book. And then, you know, I learned all the rest of the bits. And then over time, like, you know, I finished my medicine. Then I joined Ericsson to work on writing cryptographic libraries for the micropayment system. Then I realized, you know, knowing cryptography doesn't really mean anything. You need to actually For people to recognize, you need to go to some place and learn. So I then went to a research institute in India, so I could get some, how can I say, introduction recommendations. So I got in a master's and a PhD program in Royal Holloway, among other places. I was offered four of our private places. So Royal Holloway was the place that you could possibly do the whole thing in the shortest possible period in time to me. I mean, by the time I had already spent like 6+ years in university and 1 or 2 years working, and I just want to get over with it. So that's the story line.
And how was the cryptography scene before and after the blockchain kind of hype? Because I
Oh
imagine it
God.
changed quite a bit, the opportunities that were available to you back then and now.
So after I finished my grad school, got out of the grad school, I joined consulting. So I was in Capgemini and Accenture. I worked on, generally, I worked on technology. Effectively, I worked on the cloud. So I was involved in writing the standards called Cloud Security Alliance, CSA version 2.1, then moving to the cloud bias decision, all those things. And then, there were other things in general security that was, it's applied cryptography that was of use. And nobody really cared about cryptography as such. When blockchain became a thing, I think it wasn't really like people recognized the need for understanding cryptography. So it's like very, very, very few people. If you look at all the people that were in blockchain early on, you will see incredibly small fraction of people really understood cryptography. So if you look at the Ethereum team, there is nobody that had a PhD in cryptography. Absolutely nobody. You can look at the white paper, yellow paper, and take all the names, and you wouldn't see a single person who has a background in cryptography, right? So, when other things came on top, when ZK came in, that's when the requirement for more math and more, people who had actually gone to grad school, whether they finished or didn't finish, you see a lot more mathematicians and a lot more cryptographers coming in. I would say the paper that is published by Ibn Sassin and all those guys about Zero Cash, 2011, 2013, that's when the real interest came in and more cryptographers came in and they started focusing on things, and it brought along with them, it's a second order effect. There was not a first order effect. A second order effect is something happens, because of that, something else happens. So something happens, it's blockchain happens. So overall, the requirement for understanding anything was very minimal. So, anybody who could read a normal, introduction to cryptography by somebody Fred Piper could actually understand what is public key cryptography, get a sense of all the elliptical stuff, and then you could probably get on with things. But what had actually happened is when zero knowledge came in, that's when the amount of sophistication there increased quite a bit. So that required more people who really understood math to come in, and because of that, and they also saw the opportunity. So you should think of this as a second order effect of multiple things. Even though cryptography was there, the total number of people who were interested in cryptography, who actually could earn a living doing cryptography, was very limited. Even if you were interested in actually having a PhD in cryptography and you loved the topic, you would struggle to find a job, because the major employers of cryptographers were agencies with three letters, right? Some in the US, some in the UK, so they are very limited. There are restrictions to who you can work for. So, if you don't have the right kind of nationality, right kind of citizenship, you won't be able to work. So here what happened is suddenly there was value in the market. So because blockchain effectively mean crypto effectively mean, there was value there, and there's money to be paid. So the skill suddenly got value in the market, and that really resulted in, more, I would say, attracting more, I would say, cryptographers and near cryptographers. When I say near cryptographers, it's like people who did adjacent things, like algebraic number theory, all the abstract algebra, that the things that are closer to especially asymmetric crypto, right? So in a normal world of cryptography, there's symmetric cryptography, which is like the keys for encrypting and decrypting are the same. And then this asymmetric, when you have one key to lock, another key to unlock, right? So, the cryptography in crypto is asymmetric. So Bitcoin actually has a private key and a public key. Ethereum has a public key and a private key. You name it, has a public key and a private key. This is an asymmetric one. And again, this is, using elliptic curves, right? So the elliptic curve cryptography is like, came slightly later, and it had its own implementation challenges. And if you look at the history, the evolution of elliptic curve cryptography was a bit late, in a sense, like Scott Van Stone, Alpha Meneses actually, and Koblitz are the people who actually had one of the first schemes that's proposed, right? So if you look at Alpha Meneses' PhD thesis, NQE scheme, that's the scheme that he proposed, I think in the late 90s, right? And so the thing that was happened is like in the early 2000s is when we started, and because of the complexities involved in selecting curves and things like that, there was a bit more delay in the whole thing, and like cryptographic libraries need to be written. So what we ended up having right now is like both for ZK to a large extent, especially SNARK. SNARK is the variant which actually is more popular in one sense of speaking. I'll explain that as well. It uses public key cryptography, and in public key cryptography, a subset of public key cryptography called elliptic curve cryptography, right? So that's kind of where we are. And this is like had a whole bunch of math around it, especially number theory and all those things. So this, anybody who did this piece found the opportunity and was like, oh, this is stuff I know, right? If you were to do a PhD in modular forms and you wake up one fine morning and say, if I apply to a postdoc in the top university, you get paid 40-50K. Oh, there's a crypto company who wants an applied researcher. They will pay me 100K. Guess what?
Yeah. Tough choice.
Absolutely.
So from the timeline you described, what really opened up the opportunity for cryptographers in crypto was the ZK landscape. But it sounds like you've been involved in crypto before the ZK landscape was mature enough to attract talent. Yeah. And you said you founded a bunch of protocols. So you were interested in crypto besides cryptography, I imagine, since you designed these other protocols. So could you quickly tell us a little bit about these protocols that you designed and curiosity were you chasing?
Okay, so just so that you understand, when I describe protocols, this is evolution of things that had actually happened. So as I said, like my first paid job was writing cryptographic libraries for a micropayment scheme, right? So at that point in time, we had RSA, it's a reverse Shamir Alderman, the first of the two public key cryptography algorithms. The public key cryptography algorithms that said like one has a public key and a private key. The first one was Diffie-Hellman, and the second one was RSA, right? So this, in early 2000, was under patent. So Java cryptographic extensions, which is the normal thing if you have ever come across Java, this is thing called, the cryptographic library is called JCE, or Java cryptographic extension. It didn't have RSA because of the patent restrictions, because it doesn't expire. So OpenSSL still had it. OpenSSL is the crypto library that's there that implements most of the cryptography. So what had happened was like, I was brought in to write a wrapper along with a bunch of people so that we could actually invoke RSA from Java cryptographic extensions. There were other, engineering toolkits or cryptographic toolkits that were available, but were quite expensive and things like that, and there were restrictions. So, Ericsson HP, which was the company that I was working for, wanted to do this. So this is like where I started, right? So when I say protocols, especially in crypto space, what had happened is mostly when I came in really early on, it was layer ones. So for example, Ripple, I was involved with CTO Stefan working on some specific problems and consensus and some other, security related problems. When it came to Swarm, I was mostly involved in the incentive design in that sense. honestly. You know, how do you actually make sure that everybody actually gets there is no free riding in that sense. And when other protocols were there, it's mostly me coming in and explaining to people, because it was really early on in 2016, the number of people who understood how to how to design a protocol in a protocol sense, the word token engineering didn't exist, right? So I came in because it's like I have been exposed to pre-minted tokens that's been used by protocol. You can guess which one. So I was very aware of how all of this works. So for me, this was like, okay, this is how you do it, and these are the things that you need to understand. So I ended up helping other people design protocols. So along with Trent, me and Trent were the early people who gave a whole bunch of talks on token engineering. So early talks, you could probably, if you go on Google and search, you'll find my talks. And I am more on the skeptical side, and he is more on the optimistic side. And I helped Trent, I work with Trent on Ocean. So Ocean was a data marketplace for data, machine learning. And this, like, I had known Trent from the machine learning world. And when he moved into this, I was like, okay, I'll help you. I mean, as a friend, there you go. So that's the transition happened. And then people came to me and asked me for help. And I will, if some of them were like, okay, I'll help you. Here you go. Some I had to sign contracts. So, you have some commercial.
When you say you're more on the pessimistic side, what exactly are you referring to?
Okay. So in 2018, there's a Token Engineering Global Summit in Berlin. So if you listen to my talk, I think the title of the talk is A Cynic's View of Token Engineering. And I kind of describe everything, including the fact that probably less than 1% of the protocols that were alive at that point in time are going to survive. And I explained why, say, for example, data storage on-chain is simply impossible. Why MEVs are real. Like a whole bunch of things that, to most people, you might find that to be a bit, how could I say, when it's a bull run and you have somebody who stands up and says, look, folks, these other things how this is going to happen, A, B, C, D, and that is the bit that I try to do, which is like, okay, to me, crypto economics has two pieces, right? Cryptography and economics to the largest degree. I would say the game theoretic part of economics to the large degree, and then a bunch of game mechanics and design, right? So what had happened is cryptography is a very pessimistic art. What I mean by that is like you assume that your adversary has everything except the key material, the Kirchhoff's principle, right? So I think as a security person, as a cryptographer, I think with that security cryptography hat on, right? That's the hat I have. Whereas everybody who comes from other parts of the world, which is like you played around with ML, you played around with mostly ML people and some game theory people came in, and they had no understanding of the constructs of how security and cryptography worked and how protocol design from a security and cryptography perspective worked. So I was coming in from what I would describe the pessimistic end, and a lot of the people who I knew who were involved in token engineering. I mean, you can actually go on Google and put their names and see the massive failures of their early protocol designs. I don't want to name people, but you can definitely, they had huge fights. Those guys have gone on to do much better things. But in summary, what I said, I stand by my words, and Google, I can't change Google. I can't hack Google and change the indexing, right? Or I don't have I don't have a time travel machine. If I had one, I'd be in a different place, right? So having, we confirmed two facts, you could actually see the fact that what I had said about protocols have gone okay. And as a protocol designer, luckily or unluckily, at least if you were to think of the top five protocols in one sense, all the last 10 years, I was involved in two, and that still remain. So, my credibility as a protocol designer still remains more or less the same, right? And, all the other set of people who are around me haven't actually, they have made enormous amount of money. That's different, right? But they haven't had the measure of a protocol designer is how well your protocol does, and is the protocol resistant to attacks that comes in from other places. This is a key criteria for me. My criteria is not how much the protocol designer makes, and I think the difference here is like I thought of it as like you should consider a protocol as like you having a child, and then you want to train the child to enter a very adversarial world. So you want to train the child to actually take on the toughest task, and that's the best training you could give the product, your child or the protocol. So this is my thinking, whereas others had a different view. So I don't know. There you go. I rest my case.
I think it all makes sense. And crypto, in terms of the blockchain that everyone has access to the code and can interact with it, is one of the most adversarial environments, because usually there's all this bunch of layers between servers, between different infrastructures that are not easily accessible. But when it comes to crypto, there's only one layer, which is the most smart contract, and then you're right there at the front. So I think that's definitely a good perspective to have. So if you could give any advice for founders creating tokenomics and designing their new protocol, what would you tell them in and what kind of advice could you give to them that would be very practical to implement or to analyze what they're trying to do?
So, if I were being cynic and like, I have a bit of a hindsight. So, I mean, you could probably go back to the talk I was describing in 2018, this Doctrinal Engineering Summit talk that I gave. It kind of gave like an idea of, my frame of reference. I kind of described like how side channels work. So in summary, what I would describe is number one, unless there's a organic utility, you can't have a protocol that will survive. Number two, the protocol fees has to be aligned with the utility function you bring. You can't actually have a value transfer mechanism where gas charges are like $100, right? You got th that implies you can't do certain things, right? Then the third thing is like, you need to understand the characteristics of the layer one on which you operate. What that means is, say for example, if your throughput is in a particular space, or you have MEEs in a particular space, you need to understand what that implies for your protocol, right? And then, most importantly, what you need to recognize is like there is a general consensus that will be there. Every year, there will be slight variation how tokens should be allocated to all the different parties and how it should be distributed. Make sure you are in alignment. You could be one sigma away from it, but you can't be two sigma away from it, right? So there is legal challenges, which is called the legal engineering, which is like how do you structure everything in a way that you don't end up having challenges. Two is this crypto economic thing, which is like what they would describe as the token engineering piece, right? Where you engineer the protocol so that A, the users of the protocol has some value, B, there is some value that's actually being created by creating the protocol, and a fraction of the value is actually accumulated in the protocol, and C, that the overall, how could I say, ecosystem has some chance of competing with the competing centralized versions, right? So this is like this is like the important paradigm. The reason I say this is like when normally people think of things, they go, okay, you know what? I can go compete against Google. I can go compete against Amazon. What you need to recognize is this economies of scale, and the fact that they're centralized is ridiculous. That the power they have, right? So just so that you think about this in a very simple sense. So imagine this is the cost of consensus. So this is the cost of doing something in a centralized world. So imagine that's cloud compute, and you want to do a decentralized version. So this is this, right? So even though it's a cup and it doesn't weigh much, but definitely it won't be less than the phone, right? So there's always an extra cost involved. The extra cost could be higher, right? So you need to understand that what is it the value that you unlock? So the overall cost of running consensus and running the everything will be less than the overall cost for running the protocol. So there's some value being unlocked that everybody who uses the protocol gets it. So this is how I would describe it.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Do you have any resources that you recommend for people that are wanting to get more in depth?
Sure. So what I would recommend is like Zag. I forgot the lady's name. I'll send you the name. So I happen to know the lady who actually wrote the book. Can't remember the name of the book.
That's okay. I can just put it into the show
notes.
Yeah,
I'll put it in the show notes. And for the reason I say this is like when I was in Berlin, I used to run a podcast with one of my friends. His name is Nima. Now he runs Seed Club, and our podcast was called Pretopia, and we interviewed like all the normal people that at that point in time, so 2018, 2019, pretty much anybody that was there that in the small community of crypto, AI, all those things, we managed to get hold of them and we interviewed them. Because of this, we, you know, talked to people and, you know, got to talk to the author of the book as well. So I definitely can send you the name of the book. And, you know, again, going back to the question you asked, another good resource is like there are builders of protocols being interviewed on Pretopia. I believe Pretopia is still, Pretopia.fm is still there, and you can find it on other places. And of the two of us, between Nima and me, as I said, I'm the more cynical one. So if you, you know, sometimes focus on the cynical questions I ask, and now you have this real, real value of hindsight. When I asked, I didn't know those things. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't have a time travel machine. So I have asked these questions and elicited some answers from people on the other side. And you can see why I asked these questions and how, you know, those things have panned out. And then you can see how, you know, there's a downside in being cynical, right? The downside in being cynical is like you will miss a whole bunch of schemes where you would have made like a lot of money, okay? A lot of fame. The upside of being cynical is like anything you try build and you build it in a way that it succeeds, it will stay there for much, much longer. It'll have the ability, resilience to, you know, protect itself against adversaries. And one of the things that most people didn't recognize, and this is the thing that now more and more people are recognizing, is nation state got into this game, right? So yeah, I'm sure you heard about North Korea and other people, right? So once that happens, what that implies is like there are adversarial actors. So in a normal sense of what we call provable security, it's like you try to prove characteristics of a protocol using mathematical schemes and other things. You have adversaries and you have different class of adversaries. And nation state adversaries is one of the adversaries that have very large amounts of computational resources. They have the ability to do rubber hose script analysis. Rubber hose script analysis is like you get somebody and, you know, beat them up until they give you the keys. That's rubber hose script analysis. It's not a mathematical one, right? So all of these tools are available to nation states, right? So when you think about it, when you thought about like Bitcoin or Ethereum day one, I don't think any of the designers really thought of nation states as a big problem, right? Because like NSA, if they were to put all the resources in, you know, they could easily find ways around things, right? If you were to historically look where NSA was in terms of cryptanalysis, what is publicly available, right? We would know that, you know, they are typically a good few years ahead, right? So you could look at public cryptography. So before Diffie-Hellman happened, there were people in the UK, in the GCHQ, who came up with public cryptography. And before data encryption standards happened, you know, it was the data encryption standard was initially developed by IBM. It was called Lucifer. And they got some feedback from NIST. NIST implies like the front end of NSA, right? So the thing that we should recognize is the S boxes or the substitution boxes that DES has that they selected and gave back to them was very resistant to something called differential cryptanalysis, right? So essentially, it's making slight changes to text and seeing when they encrypt it, how much of change happens. And this particular attack, called differential crypt analysis, was proposed by Adi Shamir, Adi Shamir, S, right? Adilman Shamir, okay. So S of RSA, right? So he's the same guy. It's a public key cryptography RSA guy. The same Shamir, Adi Shamir, is the guy who proposed this differential crypt analysis. But this differential crypt analysis were known to these guys, like early 70s, late 60s, right? So how much see the difference? So to me, NSA is most likely, because of the hardware they have access to, the people they have access to, the resources they have access to, they'll be a good few years ahead of publicly known expertise in cryptography. So what I meant to say is, like, you know, we should always think of things as being, if nation state end of the game, the protocol design that most people have done would be toast.
I see. Yeah, that's a interesting perspective that I've never heard anyone spell it out like that.
It's kind of obvious, right? So it's like, think of...
But wouldn't you say, though, that the market forces would make the public state of cryptography just as good as the NSA, at least nowadays?
Let's do the math, okay? We don't even know how much the budget for NSA is, right? And if you look at the total number of PhDs hired by NSA, you know, NSA is the biggest employer of mathematics PhDs, right? So as I was describing, there are only very few places where you do really cryptography, right? So, you know, I went to one of the places where they do cryptography as like cryptography, right? Most places what happens is like you have somebody who actually does something adjacent and they do some cryptography on the side. Like very, very few places in the world actually have like a true just... you know, a cryptography research groups. Like Roy Holloway has one, Zurich has one, Stanford has a small group, Berkeley has a small group, UMBC has a small group. So, you know, typically that's how it is. You don't have like very large groups, right? So what you can imagine is like you get the best brains, you get the best brains and hire them and give them, like the product of probability is increased when the probability is higher. So you get the smartest of the people, put them all in the same place, give them the flexibility to work together with all the resources they want to work together. So you know, even if you are, you know, really, really, really smart, what will happen is like, because you don't have, like, typically if you think about building something, like, okay, so imagine you and I wanted to just make a cup. But in you and I, we can't physically, I mean, it's much more harder to create a paper cup, right? You and I might be able to do paper, and we might be able to do something like a cup. But imagine if there are a bunch of people, they understand the whole process. We could do like very good, right? And we don't need to know everything, right? The odds that some person knows everything is very low. So you have like people who have done PhDs in like 10 different topics, and they all come in, they could combine the expertise plus the ability to, you know, you have access to lots of things, right? Prior research, which is like there's an information arbitrage. Prior research, as I was describing, there existed prior research which allowed NSA to be way ahead of this, everybody else. So that plus a whole bunch of people with esoteric skill sets, with access to enormous amount of compute and hardware.
So you think the headcount and amount of resources doesn't even compare with the public sector, in summarizing this. So you think that there's the concentration of talent and resources in nations or like entities like the NSA is so much more than the public sector that they're always going to be ahead?
I would say there are this is a possibility, right? Historically, so assuming you're Bayesian, so when you say Bayesian, you look at the probability of A and probability of B and probability of A given B, right? So I gave you two instances, right? I gave you the instances of DAS, which proved to us that in symmetric key cryptography, NSA was way ahead. Then I gave you the example of GCHQ and development of public key cryptography, right? Again, so that gives you the prior that you have you know, progress in public key cryptography way ahead of everybody else, right? So now you have like two instances. So given that's first and the second, you know, the probability that the third time this could be valid is much higher. So as a very simple Bayesian, you could come to the conclusion it should be true.
And how do you mitigate for that?
I honestly
and what
don't
kind
know.
Of, like
I don't have an answer to such things. Yeah. So I can give you some more color to this problem, right? Like, so remember I was talking about public key cryptography and I kind of described RSA, which is integer factorization, which is the first version of public key cryptography, and then we have elliptic curve version. And the thing is, both these problems have like an underlying hard problem. For RSA is if you give given a very large number, find the largest prime, right? That's integer factorization. And if you're looking at the elliptic curve discrete log problem, what happens is like you are given a sum of points, okay? And when you're given a sum of points, you need to figure out how many times this point has been added. So this is a hard problem in the traditional computer science way, okay? Integer factorization has been proven to be in NP, but elliptic curve is not, right? But it is assumed it's much more harder than integer factorization. And the thing is, like, if you had quantum computers, right? And there is this algorithm called Shor's algorithm. And Shor's algorithm allows you to do this thing. It's in like finding cycles in abelian fields. So again, abelian, you know, you have groups and fields. A particular kind of field is called abelian. So Abel is a mathematical genius. I think he died very young, if I'm not mistaken, right? But he created a bunch of math that's been super useful for us. So finding cycles in abelian fields in the quantum computing world is in linear time. So what this means is like we are able to actually do or solve both integer factorization and elliptic curve discrete log problem in linear time. So the key sizes really doesn't matter. So in that sense, this becomes a interesting challenge, right? So if there are adversaries that we don't know who has access to quantum computers, they could pretty much break the whole thing and nobody would even know.